It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on the eve of the deadline for U.S. troops to withdraw from Afghanistan, we'll find out how the pullout mission is going, including efforts to get American citizens out of Kabul. First, we're starting to get info about the impacts of the American Rescue Plan that went into effect last month. Child tax credit payments are part of that new program, and many American families with one or more children began receiving direct payments in the middle of July in advance of filing taxes for 2021. That may have already led to a drop in food insecurity. According to the government's Household Pulse survey and the Census Bureau, those payments may have already contributed to a drop in the number of families with children reporting that they don't have enough to eat or drink in a given week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you start receiving those payments yourself? What does it mean for you and your family? Does it go toward food or other household necessities? Do you have questions about this program? Do you want to see it stay in place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Timothy Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison. He's a former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty and the author of several books, including SNAP Matters, How Food Stamps Affect Health and Well-Being and Monitoring Social Mobility in the 21st Century. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Before we get into this new research from the Census Bureau, Tim, can you remind us what these payments are, how they work, who they go to?
Yes, sure. The child tax credit, we've had child tax credits in 1997, and they were expanded to $2,000 per child in the Trump Tax Act, the Tax and Jobs Act of 2017. So in 2020, a lot of people got $2,000 off their taxes, but they excluded the bottom 35%. 10% didn't get any benefit because they had no earned income, and 23% who had earned income didn't have enough to get the whole $2,000 back. So what happened is the relief plan that was passed by Congress included an expanded child tax credit up from $2,000 to $3,000 or $3,600, depending on your kid's age, and decided to pay it out monthly to everybody starting in July. And in July, almost 60 million, 59.3 million children and 35 million families got the benefit. In August, they added 1.6 million more kids, but a huge number of kids, particularly those who are in working class families with incomes between $30,000 and $70,000, started getting this benefit. And they're going to get it every month until the end of the year. So you're either getting $250 a month or $300 a month, depending on the age of your children. And this is going to people who regularly file taxes, who've had good communication with the IRS in the past. And those people started seeing it on July 15th. And so the Census Pulse survey, which was done just before and then just after that date, registered the initial effects of this program on two things that you mentioned. One was food insufficiency, and the other is your ability to afford everyday household expenses.
So here we are with that data. Pre this payment, 11% of households, they report, families with children, reported that either sometimes or often didn't have enough to eat or drink. After these payments, the number goes down to 8%. Now, I don't know. This is a quick turnaround. First look at data here. Can we say with any confidence that these payments led to this outcome, a decline in food insecurity?
Well, the way you do that is you compare households headed by adults without children, similar age, similar earnings, similar situations, and there was no change there. So in other words, food insufficiency was the same, whatever the number was, I don't remember right now, for childless adult households. But in adult households with children who are eligible and getting this benefit, there was a drop. This is a big drop, and it's a pretty significant sign. By the way, it is also a sign of why the Biden administration has increased the SNAP benefits starting in October by 25% because they're just not enough to feed a family. So this was some good news right there. And you found the same sort of difference when you ask about having difficulty in paying bills. In fact, there was a slight uptick in difficulty for paying bills for households that didn't have children, and a decline for households that did have children. So the only thing that I know and that we know changed between those two surveys was the delivery of the child tax credit. Now, they'll do it again next month and again, and increasingly, people are going out and asking, what are you spending this money on? And finding, you know, what I consider to be really interesting and useful things. So 17% of those with at least one child under age five spent some of their CTC on childcare. So in other words, so they could go out to work or find a place to work or work a different shift. A lot of this money also went to supporting childcare. Now, it's hard to find childcare slots and things like that, and the state has some, but there was a new tax credit for childcare too, and dependent care, which could add to this. So right now, this is pretty good news for the working class, those above poverty.
You mentioned a phrase earlier that the people who are in regular contact with the IRS, people who file their taxes, is there a group out there that doesn't make enough maybe to file taxes that isn't being affected by these new credits?
Yes, there's a fairly large group. There's 4 or 5 million kids who are in families where taxes weren't filed, or where the taxes were filed by an immigrant parent with an ITIN number, or where people moved and they weren't in contact by email. The IRS had their last address. They wrote to them and said, you're eligible, and they got the letter back because the mail wasn't forwarded because the Postal Service is behind on forwarding. So there's about 5 million kids out there who should be getting this benefit, 4 to 5 million, who aren't quite getting it yet. And that's where the big take-up issues are. And if Biden and others expect that this benefit will have child poverty, you have to get to the border. So I gave the IRS an A last week in a presentation in dealing with the working class and the middle class and getting those benefits out. And I gave them a C so far in getting benefits to people who need help. People who haven't filed regular taxes, including some immigrant families who may not think they're eligible, even though they are, and so-called grand families, where a grandparent is actually raising the children because their son or daughter, the parent of their grandchildren, aren't able to do it. And we don't know how many of these there are out there. There are people who are making guesses, 3-4 million more. And we need to get to those people if we're going to have the big effect on poverty. And that's where a lot of the aid groups and groups who can work with these people to determine that they're eligible, these grandparents and immigrant parents and so forth, and try and get them out of the program too.
Timothy Smeeting is with us, a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, talking about new child tax credits that kicked in last month. Early survey research in from the Census Bureau says it may be having a pretty good impact on food insecurity, food insufficiency for families with children, bringing it down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see that payment show up in your bank account last month? What does it mean for you and your family if you're a family with children? Where is that money going? And whoever you are, what do you think of this idea as a public policy? Ends at the beginning of end of this year, excuse me. Should it continue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, can you talk about that expiration date? This is a finite program. Based on what you're seeing so far, do you think it's something that should be continued?
Well, I certainly do. In fact, and the Biden administration does. They pushed it out in July and made sure that you got, 85% of the eligibles or 88% of the eligibles. They really pushed it out because they wanted rural families, blue-collar families, families that are working hard to know that the government was going to help them support their children and raise their children, just like it helps higher-income families. And they did it. They got it out there. I know journalists who told me, hey, my three kids were getting the benefit now. And it's very easy to find a television show or somebody who will go out and find a new recipient and look at the smiles on their faces and say, oh my gosh, I can afford a good internet connection now. I can pay my back rent. I can get the kids ready for school. I can afford childcare. We can eat a better diet. And I don't have to worry about being penniless at the end of any month, because at least for the next 5 months, 4 months now, this is going to be there every month. Now, the problem is it's only monthly for 6 months. The other half of this credit will come with at tax time in 2022. So if you're an eligible family and you got $1,800, $300 a month for 6 months for your five-year-old, let's say, you can expect to get another $1,800 back from the IRS when you file your taxes or taken off your taxes or returned as a refund when you do that in February or April. But that's it. It's only 1 year. The Biden budget includes this as part of their big trillion. And this is one that I think they're not going to give up. There's a huge groundswell. There will be and is a huge groundswell of people saying, wow, this really helps. This is just what I needed. I can do things for my kids I couldn't before. And it's going to be really hard to turn off that spigot in Joe Manchin's West Virginia, in rural Wisconsin, in Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, inner city areas, and other places where people are working and not making as much money and really could use this to help support their families. So I'm hopeful and optimistic that this will be something that is continued in the fall in the budget. Many other things I think won't be continued, but this one is one I know that Democratic leadership and both houses of Congress are really in favor of.
Tim Smeeting is with us, economist at UW-Madison, talking about the expanded and advanced child tax credit payments that started rolling out to families with children last month and the impact it's having on food insecurity and other basic needs for families with children. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Just heard the question there of whether this would be extended after the end of this year. Do you think it should be? Is this having an impact on your household budget? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison's Tim Smeeting, professor of public affairs and economics, looking at the impacts of the child tax credit payments on hunger rates so far this summer. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Have you seen these payments coming to you if you are a parent with children 17 or under? What does it mean for you? Do you think this is a good policy decision? Do you want to see it extended out from the end of this year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions, or email us ideas@WPR.org. Tim, the numbers we've been looking at are national numbers. Can you give us a sense of the scope of food insecurity here in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's a little bit better. We've done, it certainly was better during the Great Recession because we did such a good job of getting SNAP benefits out there. There were some cutbacks and, you know, some things, some talk of drug testing and work tests for adults who didn't have children and so forth during the end of the Walker administration. But we're doing a pretty good job. Rates are up pretty well here, at least for the SNAP program. So I assume it's helping a lot of people in Wisconsin feed their kids too. And the other thing Wisconsinites might think about is that more money for food means higher demand for food, which means that that milk and cheese and butter we're producing is probably going to have a higher price tag on it after the benefits are distributed and after SNAP increases, because more people will be buying it and they'll have more money to pay for it. So it's good for the supply side, the Wisconsin farmer, as well as the demand side, the families who really need to feed their kids.
Got an email from Anne in Madison with a couple questions. She asks, are only households paying taxes eligible for this? Is there anything people receiving this need to be aware of when filing taxes so there aren't surprises? Anne says, I have tax preparer relatives who are concerned that there could be problems at tax time. So if I understand you correctly, Tim, no, you don't have to be paying taxes to be eligible. Do I have that right on
That's
the first
correct.
Question? Okay.
That's correct. And at tax time, there's really not going to be any problem this year. If you think about it, suppose last year you got $2,000 off your taxes for your kids, okay? This year they're going to give you $300 a month, let's say, for 6 months. They'll give you $1,800 during this time of the year. And then you're going to get another $2,200 or another $1,800, I'm sorry, when you file your taxes, and you were expecting only $2,000 anyway. I just don't see the problem. Now, does this phase out? Yes, it phases out at $150,000 for a family with children. So up to $150,000 of taxable income, there's really no effect, okay? Above that, they phase the tax out. But once you're making $140,000, $150,000, you have withholding, you have other taxes, and a difference of $200, which is what we're talking about, you might not even notice that, okay? So I think that, I mean, I really expect that few people will have to pay it back. Now, you have the following option. If you don't want it monthly and you want to get it delayed, you can go to the IRS website. They have a portal where you can go on and change it and say, I don't want it monthly. I want it annually. And they'll give you the remaining months in one lump sum in March or April when you file your taxes. So if there's a surprise, it's a small surprise. It's not a huge surprise. And given the way that it's being administered this year, with half during the end of this year and half, you know, held back, I don't think anybody's going to be hurt by it, really. At least not much. It's, you know, if you're really scared, fine. Take it at tax time. But then the problem is people get a big tax refund, especially low-income people, in February or March. And then they don't have that money. And it's great. And they can pay their bills, pay some advance rent, maybe get a new car, pay insurance, do all these things that they wanted to do. But come September and October, you don't have that money anymore because you took it once a year instead of monthly. So when somebody gets laid off in September or the car breaks down in September and you lose your job or you can't work, the monthly child tax credit comes in really handy to help pay those bills, fix the car. And that's the problem with not taking it monthly. So I think an awful lot of lower income people, maybe not the poorest, or the poorest, but not, you know, people with incomes less than $70,000 or $80,000 a year should take it monthly and they're not going to get hurt.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Greg is with us in Appleton. Greg, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I know a 37-year-old single mother of two who lives off of her child support. I convinced her to file a tax return this past year so she could get her COVID money, but she went online and her friend said because she had no earned income, not $1, that she wasn't eligible for this program. Is that correct?
No, that's wrong. She is eligible, whether she has some earnings or not. The same way that of grandparents who only have Social Security and are paying taxes on that, if they're really taking care of their grandkids, they also are eligible. She got misinformation. If she goes to childtaxcredit.gov, she can find out what she should be getting and what she has to do to go to the non-filer portal and claim the benefit. Okay, as long as those children have Social Security numbers, and as long as that mother, through child support or whatever, as long as that mother lives with that children for at least 6 months this year and pays at least half of their expenses, she is eligible.
Greg, thanks a lot for the question. And I think some of the confusion here, Tim, and I had this confusion. I've thought of this credit along the lines of the already existing earned income tax credit, but that's the big difference. It doesn't have the words earned income in it.
Correct. The earned income tax credit did not change at all. Most people with low earnings are still going to get an earned income tax credit next year. It's totally separate. This is a child tax credit. It's what middle class families have been getting for a number of years. And now we're extending it down to people like Greg's friend who needs the help. So she should go back. She should contact her local WISCAP, contact Wisconsin Extension. There are a lot of groups in the state who are working on these issues, and I write to a lot of them every week. That mother is definitely eligible for this benefit, as far as I can tell from what Greg's told me.
Greg, thanks for that call again. And Tim, that brings me back to something you said earlier about the people who don't file taxes and are eligible and don't know they're eligible. You mentioned earlier, Tim, you know, some local maybe nonprofit groups could pass the word. What would you like to see from, say, state and federal governments when it comes to finding those people who are eligible but don't know it?
That's a good question. I think they're somewhat, at least they know where to point people. There are a number of groups, Wisconsin Extension, Center for Community Alternatives in Milwaukee, the WISCAP programs, ABC Health, which has wonderful webinars, and a lot of other groups in the state, including Latino organizations, Hmong organizations, and others who are trying to spread the word. And when people talk to their friends and find out they're getting the benefit, well, why aren't I? Hopefully they can manage to get on. And again, the place to start is childtaxcredit.gov, which is a general information site that tells you what you need, which IRS portal you need to go to, and what you need to have when you go to the IRS portal. And you're going to have to give up some sensitive information. You're going to have to give up your kids' Social Security numbers. You're going to have to give up your address. You're going to have to sign that you're supporting your kids and you're taking care of them for at least 6 months of the year. And if you want to make things really easy, you're going to have to give the IRS your bank account, in which case they will automatically deposit this child credit in that account. Will they take anything from you? No. If this mother who is receiving just child support decides that she can afford to go to work now because she can afford some child care, that and she earns money, an earned income tax credit in addition. But for every dollar she gets in the child tax credit, no one's going to reduce the kid's Medicaid eligibility. No one's going to reduce their food share benefit, and so on. So this program doesn't have a substitution effect. That's why it's kind of a credit, a universal credit. Everybody gets this money to help support their kids because the government realizes it's expensive to have kids. And it's in everyone's interest to have kids have better chances.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. That was great, Rob. And people know where to find me, smeeting@wish.edu. And yes, I do answer my emails.
Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about new government data showing that the percentage of families with children experiencing hunger has gone down after the new child tax credit payments started going out. Coming up, we'll get the latest on U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan and what America's future in that country may look like. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, winter is coming, and help is on the way on this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. Get advice on insulation, what to choose, where to put it, and how to get your money's worth. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the 20-year U.S. deployment to Afghanistan is in its final hours. According to the White House, more than 116,000 Afghans and U.S. citizens have been airlifted out of the country over the past couple weeks. That includes the U.S. Corps diplomats this morning. A Pentagon spokesperson said it's not too late for remaining Americans to fly out of Kabul. Meanwhile, U.S. missile defenses intercepted as many as 5 rockets fired at Kabul's airport. The military says there were no American casualties. Islamic State's Afghanistan affiliate claimed responsibility. That happened after the same group claimed it carried out the suicide bombing at the airport that killed more than 100 people, including 13 U.S. service members, last week. The U.S. also launched a drone strike against Islamic State suicide bombers, hitting a car packed with explosives yesterday. Officials say they're looking into reports of civilian casualties. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts and your questions about what's going on in Afghanistan? Is the U.S. doing the right thing by pulling troops out, or do you think the nation should keep some troops in the country? How do you feel about President Biden's handling of the situation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Nicholas Grossman is a professor of international relations at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and senior editor of ARC Digital. He's also the author of Drones and Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare, and the Threat to Global Security. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Big picture, Nick, what's your overall read on what's happening in Afghanistan as this deadline to pull the troops out comes nearer and nearer?
So big picture, I think the most important thing people need to understand is that this was a situation with no good options that the United States was faced with after 20 years of war of either continuing the same thing indefinitely without any hope of victory or pulling out and seeing something like what we're seeing now, some sort of collapse of the Afghan government with the Taliban taking over. And it's probably going to be a security concern for quite a while. And there's a lot of tragedy surrounding it. And there have been various mistakes by the U.S. government, but in many ways, it was probably headed here at some point.
There's been support for the U.S. troop withdrawal. A majority of Americans in polls saying, yes, pull troops out. But late last week, at least in the short run, people are saying 84% saying U.S. troops should stay until all Americans are evacuated, however long that takes. 71% say troops should stay until all Afghan allies who help the U.S. are evacuated. Do we have that option at this point to have troops stay longer than tomorrow to finish up the evacuation?
Not really. The deal was for originally when Trump struck the deal with the Taliban, that was for the end of May. Biden got it revised to the end of August, but they are saying pretty strongly that they want the U.S. to stick with it, which means that they might start using force if the United States doesn't leave. And we saw from the recent terrorist attack from ISIS's local branch in Afghanistan that there are considerable costs for the United States staying. So it's possible that maybe the U.S. could draw it out a day or two, a little longer. But beyond that, it would probably require military escalation and more U.S. casualties.
One of the biggest parts of this story, I think, Nick, is how quickly the Taliban swept through the country as U.S. troops withdrew. What happened? Why did the Afghan government and military dissolve, in effect, so quickly?
That was surprising to everybody with the speed. And when I say everybody, not just the United States and a lot of international actors, a lot of other U.S. allies, but also it seems like the Taliban themselves were quite surprised by it. But they were set up for a takeover first by the February 2020 deal that the United States signed with them, in which negotiated, not formally signed, but agreed to with them that the U.S. was going to withdraw in 2021. And then also the United States got the Afghan government to release a bunch of Taliban prisoners, up to about 5,000 prisoners, while the Afghan government was cut out of this deal. So if you were a Afghan soldier and you saw that the United States had pulled its support and you were dependent upon U.S. military support, things like air support and intelligence and equipment maintenance and logistics, and that was all going away, and the United States showed that it had no confidence in your government, and that government was pretty incompetent and corrupt anyway, then perhaps you would not be as interested in putting your life on the line to fight more. But it was surprising with the speed. And what it means is the Taliban set up a lot of these deals in advance, that they went to various local leaders, say tribal elders, other community leaders, and cut deals, probably with threats that the local option was either work with the Taliban, surrender to them, or fight them. And if the Afghans couldn't really handle the Taliban without U.S. support when they had a whole military together, they probably couldn't and would reasonably be afraid without U.S. support. But the biggest trigger for the collapse, at least in Kabul, was the president, Ashraf Ghani, deciding to flee in what was a surprise not only to the United States, but even to a lot of his senior aides.
We're talking to Nicholas Grossman, international relations expert at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, looking at the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson was on Upfront over the weekend and said the U.S. should have done a lot of things differently with regard to Afghanistan. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
We should have really planned. We should not have given up Bagram Air Force Base. We should have identified the special immigrant visa holders, the people that did fight side by side that are in grave peril being slaughtered by the Taliban. We should have rounded up any U.S. citizen that wanted to get out of there, and we should have done that months ago, not days before the planned withdrawal. So again, this was so incompetently planned, carried out. I mean, this is just a travesty. It's a tragedy.
What do you think of Senator Johnson's critique, Nick?
So I think he's partially right and partially wrong. And of course, he's a Republican senator. The president is a Democrat, so he has political incentives to be very critical. The part where I think he's right is that the planning by the Biden administration was pretty poor. In particular, they put a lot of eggs in the basket that the Afghan government and military would hold out for a while. And as recently as July, President Biden, the chair of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, were in public saying things like the Taliban takeover is not inevitable, and at least the Afghans will hold out for a long time. And some of the Biden officials were on vacation or taking kind of their first break of the new presidency while Kabul was falling, or as it was just about to fall and the Taliban was advancing on it. So that part seems to be a pretty poor planning. The part about SIVs, the visas that would allow Afghans to get here, is one that falls on both the Biden and Trump administrations. The Trump administration had slowed a lot of those visa processing in the last year, which then meant that there was a big backlog, but the Biden administration did not process them all that quickly. In terms of the other part that Senator Johnson said about things like keeping Bagram Air Base, that strikes me as more, say, armchair generaling, something that hasn't really thought through a lot of the implications. So that airbase in particular is about 40 miles north of Kabul. It's in a remote area. The roads to get there go through mountains. They're winding. There are tons of places that people can set up checkpoints and ambushes. A lot of it's vulnerable to sniper fire, to IEDs. And the United States never really controlled that road along the way. The U.S. mostly flew in and out of the base by helicopter. And that's fine if it's just U.S. military. If you're trying to do evacuations, that would mean people would need to get there. And the United States did not have close to the force to defend that road. So that, along with quite a few other criticisms that end up nitpicking things, are, I'd say, probably the best case is wishful thinking of, oh, couldn't it be better that there was this kind of one simple solution that we stupidly didn't do? And that's just not the case. It's a really complex, complicated, and potentially violent environment in which there was no easy solution.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in favor of them pulling the troops out, but in the manner in which they did it is what's disturbing to me. I've been hearing the past 15, 20 years about how complicated it is in Afghanistan and how we went about doing what we were doing, fighting the war on terror. To me, as an average citizen, and I'm a veteran and I served overseas as well, it just reeks of incompetence from start to finish with Iraq, Afghanistan, how we pulled out of Iraq, ISIS came in, and then it turned into a big problem then, and then here we're doing it again in Afghanistan. I'm just seeing a lot of failure from the top down in both military and presidential leadership, and I expect better from my leaders that I elect to conduct themselves far more professional and more understanding of what we wanted to accomplish when we pull out of there. We don't want to have a lot of unnecessary dangers to our troops and to the civilian populations, but we did it anyways. And it's, you know, it seems redundant every time you get into a conflict, we pull out so hastily. It just looks horrible. And the world is watching, and we look like a bunch of idiots out there.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Jeremy's seeing haste and incompetence, Nick.
I agree with Jeremy in that I guess this part I disagree, where I probably would not have pulled out. I think that in many ways, and I'd written this for years, but in many ways that this is what we're seeing now is part of the reason that there wasn't all that much the United States could do that would make the withdrawal look smooth. Definitely things that the U.S. could have done better, you know, certainly wasn't perfect, but things that could have been smoother. I think it's also good that Jeremy took the picture of the war as all 20 years of it, as opposed to something that just suddenly happened in the last year or two. It has been going poorly in various ways throughout most of the conflict. And in particular, because the goal of setting up a Afghan government that would be both elected and stable and able to, and an Afghan military also that could hold the entire country on its own, was always a very ambitious goal. Some might say impossible. So it was possible that things would never look all that good, but also our political leaders, and this goes for leaders of both parties, were never really honest with the American people. We heard a lot of things about how just another push or another 6 months or another year and the U.S. will be able to hand over security to the Afghans and withdraw. And that was never true. And we're seeing the consequences of that now.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. We're talking about what's going on in Afghanistan as U.S. troops are finishing their withdrawal from the country. Nicholas Grossman is with us, professor of international relations at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what's on your mind and how you're feeling about Afghanistan. What do you think of the Biden administration's handling of the situation? Do you support the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan? Would you have liked to have seen it earlier? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the U.S. role in Afghanistan. The Pentagon announced today that the U.S. war in Afghanistan ended at 3:29 Eastern Time, so 2:29 Central Time, on August 30th, 2021. The White House says more than 122,000 people have been airlifted out of Afghanistan over the last month. As many as five rockets were intercepted by U.S. missile defenses near the Kabul airport. Nicholas Grossman is with us, professor of political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of Drones and Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I think this whole thing is just bad form. I completely agree with Jeremy. Just the way this looks to the rest of the world, the rest of the world is watching and they're taking note. To the rest of our allies around the world and to countries that are thinking about working with us, this is how we leave them. I mean, you know, either we have to be in it for the long haul or not do it at all, really, because if we're not planning to stay somewhere for at least two generations and change the mentality, change the mindset to where the older generation is not of a point where they could still resume, like, take back the power. If we're not going to do that and do like what we did in South Korea, but we're going to continue to do like South Vietnam and now Iraq and Afghanistan. If this is our pullout game, then we should prepare that we are going to leave them knocked up with problems for us to come in the future.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jim saying, Nick, we need to be in not for one generation, but two generations or more if we want to have a successful military intervention in a place like Afghanistan. What do you think?
If something was going to work in Afghanistan, it would have taken a really long time. And I think that's the right mindset of it would have taken generations. I also agree that the world is watching the U.S. and the U.S. looks pretty bad. The one part where I disagree is that the way that they will interpret this is by doubting the U.S. commitment to them. So first, the political science research on this says that reputation doesn't really transfer much like that, that people put a lot of stake in how you've treated them in the past, but not necessarily how you've treated others, especially if others aren't like them. So if you think of somebody like Taiwan or Israel or somebody in Eastern Europe, if they're looking at Afghanistan, their situation is nothing like those at all. So to give an example, Taiwan, of where it's an island, it has a cohesive government, cohesive military, it has a whole lot of missiles that are pointed at China, it has a long-running relationship with the U.S. The United States does not have to do active combat in Taiwan in the way that it never had to stop doing in Afghanistan. And also, a bunch of countries are seeing that the United States spent 20 years and trillions of dollars and thousands of lives on a conflict that is not a core American strategic interest in the way that, say, countering Russia or China or perhaps the Iranian or North Korean nuclear programs are. That there wasn't something from Afghanistan once Al-Qaeda was pushed out. There wasn't something from Afghanistan directly threatening the United States on a regular basis, whereas something like, say, Taiwan and China, China is a great rival for the U.S. So I wouldn't be so quick to say that everybody's looking at this and thinking, oh, well, now this means America is going to abandon me because they know their situation is different, though they might think maybe I overrated U.S. competence a little and have more doubt in the United States as a result.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rebecca in Waupaca. Rebecca, hi.
I was just wondering if you could kind of talk to just sort of what the American people that were what might have been told in Afghanistan. I lived in Myanmar, and during the coup, they kind of said, okay, this is bad. Maybe you want to go. Here are some flights you might take. And then we're going to take these people out of the embassy, but you can go. Here are some flights you might take. But they never like said we had to go. And I'm wondering what the people in Afghanistan might have been told and what their options were before right now.
Thanks for the call, Rebecca. Before you answer, Nick, I want to give a listen to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on CBS Face the Nation yesterday talking about the goal of bringing Americans home safely. Here's a listen.
What we are doing right now, Ed, is working one by one with those individuals and their families to direct them to a rally point near the airport, to come into the airport and to get on the planes and go home. There are those Americans, though, Ed, and this is important, who have chosen thus far not to leave Kabul. Maybe they've lived there for many years. Maybe they have extended family there. Our message to those Americans is that after August 31st, we will make sure there is safe passage for any American citizen, any legal permanent resident. And yes, we will ensure the safe passage of those Afghans who helped us to continue coming out after the 31st of August. But-
So we heard from Jake Sullivan there, National Security Advisor, and then Rebecca's experience in how much the U.S. government can warn and cajole people to leave the country. What, Nick, do you make of the efforts to get Americans out, even if they feel like they're not quite ready to leave Afghanistan?
It was mediocre at best at first. There were some announcements of everybody, you know, we recommend that you leave the country. It's not clear necessarily that everybody in Afghanistan would see that. Then when the government in Kabul collapsed, when the Afghan government and military and police were all gone, then the U.S. military scrambled and did a rather impressive airlift in which they got a whole lot of people out. And in some cases, you know, with tragedy, both there was the terrorist attack at the airport, but also I'm guessing a lot of people saw the footage of some Afghans running after and then climbing onto the planes and even one or two falling off once the planes were quite high, and which is really sad. But the part that Sullivan said about the United States will guarantee the security for any Americans trying to get out or any Afghans trying to get out, that's not realistic at all. The United States is pulling its military out of Afghanistan that it will already did not have a large presence in the country after the February 2020 deal. The U.S. had drawn down to about 2,500 troops. Biden had added some to aid the evacuation. But that means that with the exception of, you know, perhaps say, intelligence or some special operations forces. And also this goes for ones of other countries. There was a story just recently of some Ukrainian forces that did this risky rescue where they got some Afghans to the airport who then were flown to Canada. So there is still some of that, but the U.S. military footprint in the country is greatly reduced and about to disappear, I guess already officially disappeared this afternoon. And that means that the United States cannot guarantee safe passage for Americans or for Afghans that worked with the United States. At best, what the United States can do is try to cut a deal with the Taliban or put pressure on the Taliban to allow them safe passage. But otherwise, unfortunately, to at least some extent, the people who are still there that want to get out are on their own. The United States just lacks the capability to do it. That would require effectively reinvading Afghanistan.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. In just under a minute, Nick, we've got a caller wondering about the use of drones for counterterrorism in Afghanistan. I know you've written a whole book about it. Are you expecting to see an expanding use of drones in Afghanistan?
We'll likely see some of it. It depends on whether the United States tracks Al-Qaeda or ISIS there and how much the U.S. thinks that any of those groups are plotting anti-American attacks or attacks against U.S. allies as opposed to just against Afghans. We already saw a strike against what the U.S. military are calling ISIS-K planners because of response to the terrorist attack at the airport. Though that also means when they just say a vague term like planners, that this was not the people who were either the leadership of the group or directly responsible for that particular attack. And then there was the attack in Kabul. The U.S. launched the drone strike, which was likely against a vehicle, at least according to, say, the U.S. military. It was against a vehicle that had a lot of explosives on it that was probably headed for an attack, quite possibly at the airport. But also there are numerous reports of civilian casualties and perhaps 10 and including some children. And that is the ugly reality of trying to stop terrorist attacks in a urban environment where there are a lot of people around. It's a really terrible situation. So I think the U.S. will continue trying to use drone strikes, especially against identified members of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but it's going to be harder to get there. The U.S. will have to fly from a further distance, can't take off from bases in Afghanistan anymore, and also will find that it has less intelligence, less reliable intelligence on the ground, having now pulled out.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Nicholas Grossman from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign looking at the latest in Afghanistan. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out if Wisconsin's at risk of becoming a COVID-19 hotspot like Florida. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. What has four legs and swims and eats like a predatory dinosaur? Just when you thought it was safe to hop in your time machine, go back 43 million years and jump in the water, a new discovery may make you think again. As reported by NPR, Egyptian scientists revealed the discovery of fossils from a prehistoric four-legged whale. Let's stop there for a moment. Whales are mammals, right? And they evolved apparently from four-legged land mammals. Okay, so here's this member of the whale family tree. It's still got the legs, and its remains were found in the Sahara Desert, which apparently was underwater millions of years ago. So far, not too surprising, but these scientists keyed in on the teeth and jaws. Lots of teeth. Pointy teeth and powerful jaws. Researchers compared it to a raptor-style dinosaur in the way it would have attacked creatures and eaten them. They named it Phaiomesitus Anubis. Anubis is an ancient Egyptian god associated with death and the afterlife. Quoting one of the researchers, this whale was a god of death to most of the animals that lived in this area. So what's next? I think it's clear. Producers of made-for-streaming monster movies, this is your moment. Attack of the Anubis Sea Creature. But you could do better with the movie title. I'm not good at that. But I will watch it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.